I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. Veteran television actor Michael J. Fox has written four books, three of them memoirs. In his latest memoir, No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality, Fox gets personal about his Parkinson's and how he's adapted to it.
We have to be honest about what's happened. We have to abject truth, the things that just are what they are. And you accept that, and then you can change. You find niches in it to make it better, but you have to accept it for what it is first.
In this conversation, first recorded on September 17th for Washington Post Live, Fox talks less about his career and more about his family, how important they are to him, and how important they were to getting to the honesty depicted in No Time Like the Future.
This is your fourth book and your third memoir. And in this one, you open by talking about an injury you sustained after spinal surgery in 2018 that resulted in you having to learn to walk again. One, I want to know why that was, but also what was it about that challenge in particular that forced you to rethink your trademark positive outlook on life?
Well, to give a little backstory, I had Parkinson's for 30 years at this point. This was 2018, and so I kind of said to people, I reached a detente with the disease. I would do what I needed to do, and I would do what I didn't need to do, and we'd get along and get by, and it would gradually take more and more, and there'd be more loss. But it kind of felt like on my terms, and so I might have been cocky about that, but that's how I felt it was going. And then I had a couple of years previous, they had found a tumor on my spine, a benign tumor, but it was a tumor that was encasing the spinal cord, and therefore it was going to paralyze me within a couple of years. So if I wanted to avoid that, I needed to get this surgery, which was really tricky. It was 6 hours. It was Johns Hopkins, amazing team of doctors and assistants, and they did this thing. But I was basically, for the time being paralyzed, had to learn to walk again and literally learn the mechanics of walking, heel strike, foot transfer, weight transfer, just to keep hips forward, shoulders back. I mean, just the basic fundamentals that you see a three-year-old or a two-year-old toying with in the park, getting up and falling down and tumbling over. And that was my standard situation. So I spent a summer recouping from the surgery, and I was getting to where I could walk a little more independently. And my family were giving me a hard time, saying I was being too cocky and moving too fast. And I said, relax, I'm fine. I know what I'm doing. I'm an athlete. I'm a stuntman. So I talked them into leaving me alone in the apartment one day because I was going to go to, they were in Martha's Vineyard. And I flew back to New York and I was going to go do a cameo on a Spike Lee produced movie for Netflix. And so my daughter was in town. She was the only one in town, and she wanted to stay and get me off to work in the morning. And I said, no, I'm fine. Just go home, honey. You have to go to work in the morning. You're fine. And I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm a grown-up man. I know what I'm doing. And I woke up the next morning. I went to get coffee. I stepped in the kitchen. I fell down, and I shattered my humerus in my left arm. It eventually took a rod and 19 pins to put it back together. But in the meantime, when it just had happened, I was lying on the kitchen floor alone. And I knew that my arm was in bad shape. I couldn't feel it. And grabbed my way over to the wall and got on my cell phone and called my assistant and had her call an ambulance and come over. And while she was on her way over, I sat there and just ripped myself a new one. I just said, this is all the work that people put into you and all the effort people put into you and all the belief in you doing your best and you're doing the right thing. And you blow it. You're just cocky and you take a wrong step and so I'll shatter. You had to learn to walk in, your balance was gonna be off. And I started to think, what is this like to make lemonade out of lemons? I mean, I'm out of the lemonade business. I can't put a shine on this. I can't make this happy. I can't make this good. I can't make this, so don't worry, it's just a shattered arm. It was a real lesson to me in that moment, and I really wallowed in it. It took me months to get over it. Sometimes you excoriate yourself so severely that you leave scars. You can tell you what other people are doing damage to you. You can be damaged to yourself by saying the wrong thing to yourself at the wrong time. And it has lasting implications. So it took me a long time to get over that.
You know, Michael, I think you write in the book that in that moment that you're talking about is when you hit your rock bottom. You were just saying how you were ripping yourself a new one. But you also write a great deal about your dynamic family life. How has life as a family man helped you stay positive and maintain your sense of what you call realistic optimism?
Well, it's my kids are amazing. Everybody's kids are amazing. But mine are grown up with this their whole life. My son was the only one who knew me before I was before I had Parkinson's. But I was an alcoholic at the time, so he just distorted a view of what was happening. He was 3 years old or 2 years old. But he grew up with a real understanding of it, and a real patience with it, and a sixth sense about it, about how to negotiate around it. And as did on my daughters are much more prone to want to take care of me than my son is. My son's looking like, you know, just knows that don't run into that tree that dad just ran into. But my daughters are like more stop me from hitting the tree. I don't promote that a lot. I try to be as independent as I can with my family and let them know that they their love is enough. They don't have to. And another thing that I tend to fall a lot, and my family are always want to grab me and catch me or stop me from falling. And meanwhile, my brain is doing an elaborate gyroscopic, finding its balance, finding its appropriate sense of situation. And so when they grab me, it all goes to pot, and then we all go down. So I live in fear of knocking down. So it's my family. It's kind of an odd thing because, like my mother, I haven't hugged my mother in 2.5 years because I'm afraid of knocking her down. And then I went and saw her, and shortly after there was the pandemic, and I haven't seen her. She's in Canada, so I can finally go see her. So my family is really important. My original family and my acquired family and then just the family of Parkinson's patients. It's all about family. It's all about connections. I mean, life is about connections. If you live a whole life and you don't make any connections, you don't make any of those bonds, and none of this stuff can be healed.
That is, I agree with you 100% on that. You know, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you have been living with Parkinson's. You were diagnosed with Parkinson's 30 years ago, and you write in the book that you thought that diagnosis would be the end of your acting career. And yet you went on to play some acclaimed roles on television. You played Dr. Kevin Casey on Scrubs. You played Louis Canning on The Good Wife, Dwight on Rescue Me. What attracted you to these characters? And how did you morph your Parkinson's symptoms into what your characters were dealing with?
Well, I realized if I wanted, I dropped out of acting in 2000. I left Spin City in the capable hands of Charlie Sheen and started the foundation, which is still going concern. I decided not to work anymore, and because the doctor said I had 10 years left to work, and so I figured 10 years had passed, and I wasn't functioning the way I used to. I couldn't do work the way I used to. I didn't be as glib or as quick or as fast or as light on my feet or as acrobatic in a way. I just thought all my tools were gone. And then I got an offer to do my friend Bill Lawrence's show, Scrubs. That was Ted Lasso, but he did Scrubs at the time. And he asked me to do one, and I said, you know, I come with a lot of baggage. I don't know if I can do this. And I did it, and I realized that I took the character I had OCD, and I took it and put it through the Parkinson's filter. And I realized that in a sense, everyone has Parkinson's. It's just finding that person's Parkinson's, whatever that is. With Dwight, it was Dwight on Rescue Me. It was alcoholism and addiction and misogyny and general misanthropic behavior. and then Louis Canning was an interesting guy because he was a lawyer who had Parkinson's and used it to cultivate sympathy with the jury. And he would make it all about him. And then he would defend drug companies that were being sued for malfeasance. not having the weight anymore, being a leading man, being the guy at number one on the call sheet, carrying the show, having all that pressure. I was just this guy could slip in, put on these characters, use my own experience to blend and create a new experience for them, and do it. And it just became this thing. All of a sudden, it was like not like a job anymore. It was a hobby, and it was just a good experience. And it gave me a second act. I realized less is more, which is good because I had less. And use more of it.
You know, Michael, you anticipated a question I was going to ask you about what you write in the book. I can play anyone as long as they have Parkinson's, and I was discovering everyone has Parkinson's, and you talked about that. But I want you to get to talk more, and I think you just talked about him, Lewis Canning, and you also talked about the fact that your character was peculiar in ways, using his Parkinson's as a way of currying favor with juries. But the question is, why do you think that role left such an impression with viewers?
I don't know. I tell a story in the book about it, being at the beach with my wife, and I went down to the water and tested it out. We both did, and came back. She ran ahead of me and got on the towel and started to dry off. And I came up and sat down, and this lady came up and said, "Mr. Fox, I have a confession to make." And I'm with my wife, and I don't want to hear this lady's confession, whatever it is. And what she said, "I saw you going in the water, and I felt this incredible feeling of loathing and disgust." And I said, "Oh, that's nice." And she said, "Yeah." And then I realized it was Lewis Canning. That's why. She just saw Lewis Canning going into the water. She said, "I hate that guy." Excuse me. And she realized that it was me, and then she felt she had to apologize to me for that. And I said, "That's the greatest compliment you could ever give me."
Sorry, you true to form, you're making me laugh, Michael. You're making me laugh. I want to go to an audience question. This is a question that comes from the Commonwealth of Virginia, from Kimball Boone. She wants to know, what parts of your memoir were most challenging to write?
I think one thing that was hard to write was when I had this kind of post-operation kind of psychotic break, the reaction to the drugs I take for Parkinson's, mixed with the drugs that I took for the operation, and I kind of was hallucinating and kind of out of it. Now, it was only tough because at the time I wasn't aware of what was happening, but my daughter was there during it, and she was a psychology major, so it was like a field day. It was like a busman's holiday for her. She was watching me look freaky, but that was tough. It was tough to write, tough to break down other people's observations of what was happening, and coupled with my observations from this kind of damaged position. But then it was also hard to write about my so I had to write about Tracy because I'm not a good enough writer to really get to the depth of what that connection is with the person who commits to you and commits to you early in what's going to be a long journey and a long slog and a lot of challenges. And she committed to me and had been with me through all this stuff and to this minute is like aware of everything that's going on with me and yet not suffocating me with it and making it my burden that I'm her burden. It's really a remarkable relationship. And so it's tough to pay justice to that, but not go overboard and not make it treacly. We're not really sentimental people. You think with all my optimism and all that stuff that I'd be sentimental. I'm a realist. I mean, I just think that there's, I picked up the New York Times the other day and looked at the front page. And there were four stories that were all, I don't know into them, but they were all just horrible. There's floods and disease and social injustice. And I just went, it's got to be something in the next page. It's, make this a little lighter. And there's got to be something, not lighter, but more understandable. If we just understand, and if I can understand the connections that people have and the way that we can help each other and the way that we can get each other through, we don't have to look and say, "Oh, that person has that. That's her thing," but say, "That's my thing. We have this. We all have this. And that's what I have in my family. We all have this. And we all get by it the best we can."
You know, this is your third memoir. And I'm wondering, you know, when you write these memoirs, one, do you have your family read them before you hand them in to the editor. And I'm wondering, what reactions do you get from your family?
They're really interesting. My daughters are most amazing because they're just my daughters, and they own me. So whatever they say, they goes double for me. But they're interested. They track of the broader notes of the emotion of it, or the message of it, or whatever we talk about that. But then they'll say, no, I got a B in this class, and I got an A in this class, or I went here, I went to Sally's on Friday, and went to Wendy's on Thursday, and I mean, stuff like that is really great, and I love that. I said, well, put that in, and I love creating, especially my daughter Skylar, who was there the night before I got hurt, recreating conversations with her, where I know that that's what she said, and I know that that's what I said. And I know, and it's just such a beautiful experience. And then have her read it and affirm it and say, yes, that's the way I saw it too. But I saw this other thing that you didn't see that I was worried about certain potential problems. It's an interesting thing to delve into family and present these situations. But this book more than any of the others, I really wanted to concentrate on the dialogue and the communication. It wasn't so much about atmospherics. There's enough atmospherics with the injuries and the surgeries and all that stuff. But I wanted to concentrate on just conversations between people that love each other and try to help each other. And know that sometimes you can't. You just can't. You have nothing to bring to it other than love. And ultimately that can work.
You're already close. You and your family are already close. So you rely on them a lot. Has having them read through, particularly this memoir, actually brought you closer? Did you find that you got closer to people you were already super close to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that my son, again, he read it, and he was it's a funny family. Like we call it, my kids call me dude, but not dude like the dude, but D-O-O-D. Which I don't know what that means, but Tracy and I have a kind of what was his name, a great director, down in my head, but that kind of 40s, remember, and we just whack at each other with stuff, and it's a fun dynamic, mm-hmm. but it means you have to stay invested in it. You have to ask what's going on. And one of the things that was really cool, if I can go into this really quickly, and I don't want to jump any question you might have had about it, but during the pandemic, we were all in the house together. And my son was in Los Angeles, but all the girls and Tracy and I, and it was great. Like, she made meals, and we did jigsaw puzzles, and we read books, and we had these great conversations after dinner. My kids and the stuff in Minnesota was happening. So great conversations about that, and great conversations about social injustice and disease and dystopian societies that we may live in. And it's just blown away. I just thought, come on, where did this come from? And so meanwhile, I have Parkinson's, I have a broken arm, I have problems walking, and I have my dog died, who I love very much during the time. And yet it's all good. It just is what it is. And you can be real, like I said, you can be realist and optimist at the same time, because you see this stuff. And we were aware of the fact that, well, we were enjoying that space and that time, that people were waving at beds going down hallway corridors that would never come back with their person on it, with their loved one on it. And when that, you know that reality exists, it makes you think about the other reality that you're enjoying.
You know, Michael, we are running out of time, so I'm going to ask you real quickly. Can you talk about your foundation, the Michael J. Fox Foundation? Talk about the progress and advancements made in the last 30 years.
Well, in the last 30 years, since we started, we've been involved in this have happened organically in other ways, but it all seems to connect. We found we're getting new gene modifiers and gene identifiers, and, and realizing that, that there are certain groups that are prone and likely to get Parkinson's. We're studying them, and we're getting a big PPMI, which is a multi-million dollar study that trying to find a biomarker. So our hope is, our soonest hope is that sometime within the next 10 years or so, we'll find a way to identify the disease before symptoms are evident. So, and we're getting close. So that kid can go to get a blood test at six, and they say he's got Parkinson's, and then we treat it prophylactically, and it never manifests itself. So that would be a huge thing. But as to whether or not we're going to come up with an answer in my lifetime, I don't know. I hope so.
You know, last question for you, Michael. As a realistic optimist, what is your advice to folks who are struggling to stay positive as we, one, continue to confront this pandemic, this coronavirus pandemic, but also staying positive for people who are dealing with their own, as you say, everyone has Parkinson's, as they deal with their own version of that?
I think it's about acceptance. I think it's about acceptance, and acceptance doesn't mean resignation. It doesn't mean you can't endeavor to change it, but you have to accept it for what it is. At first, I have Parkinson's. Now what do I do? Then it takes up that much space, and I have all this other space that I can work in and thrive and come up with new ways to adapt my life to this situation. And it's the same with me. We have to be honest about what's happening. We have to abject truths, the things that just are what they are. And you accept that, and then you can change. You can find niches in it to make it better, but you have to accept it for what it is first.
Acceptance, that is the key word. Michael J. Fox, what a pleasure to meet you. Thank you very, very much for coming to Washington Post Live.
Thanks for listening to Capehart. It's produced by Julie Deppenbrock. We'll have new episodes for you every Tuesday. I'm Jonathan Capehart. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.